discovered along the way of my research that there is a sizable network of underground therapists who are administering these drugs illegally. They're often very professional people trained as therapists, and they just feel that the value is so great of working with these medicines that they're willing to risk their freedom by doing it. I'm sure there are some in your community.
That's Michael Pollan, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Michael Pollan on Notes from the Psychedelic Underground. The legalization of marijuana across the U.S. and Canada is making headline news. The study of the medical uses of psilocybin and other psychedelics does not. Academic research of psilocybin found in hallucinogenic mushrooms, lysergic acid, and ecstasy is ongoing at major universities around the world. What can we learn from the peer-reviewed articles on the uses of LSD for alcoholism, microdosing of LSD for depression, and palliative care to help the terminally ill die peacefully? The Food and Drug Administration has approved some initial clinical trials, and psychotherapists are experimenting in both clinical and clandestine settings. There's a quiet revolution in the way doctors and government officials talk and think about psychedelics. In just a few years, some of these drugs could be publicly available. To talk about this issue is Michael Pollan. He teaches writing at Harvard and the University of California at Berkeley. He's a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine and the best-selling author of In Defense of Food, The Botany of Desire, and How to Change Your Mind. Time Magazine named him on its list of the 100 most influential people in the world. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado. And now, Michael Pollan.
I want to make sure you're in the right place. There is another Michael Pollan who apparently writes about food and nutrition. I'm somebody else. I've changed. I do want to just say a word on how I got from food to psychedelics, because it may not be immediately apparent. But even though I've written the last three books or so were about food and nutrition and agriculture, I see that as a branch on a tree that the trunk of which is concerned with nature and our engagement with the natural world. And that's been my subject back from my very first book, Second Nature, which is really a book about my garden, which I return to actually in this book. And this kind of like curiosity about how we use other species and how they use us. Of course, we use other species to feed ourselves, but also for beauty and sweetness and to change consciousness. It's one of the most curious human desires, and it's universal. There is not a culture on Earth that doesn't have some plant or fungus that they use to change consciousness. There actually is one exception. But it's an exception that proves the rule. The Inuit, the Eskimos, don't. But that's only because nothing good grows there. When they get to Canada, they get with the program. And you, no doubt, have used a plant or a fungus to change consciousness today, whether it was a cup of coffee, chocolate, cannabis, any number of things. So I've always had this interest in this peculiar desire and the different species that gratify it for us, and trying to figure out what is it good for? Why did it survive in evolution? Because changing consciousness, especially radically with psychedelics, leaves you in a pretty defenseless place, right? It's this long-standing interest. And then I started hearing about these research projects going on at very, you know, mainstream institutions like NYU and Johns Hopkins. And they were doing things like, somebody sent me a paper, this is back in 2006, that about the use of psilocybin in healthy normals, as they call them, to see if they could use psilocybin, that's the ingredient in magic mushrooms. I have to read you the title of this paper because it was so unusual. It's appropriate we're in a church, by the way, because spirituality is part of what we're doing here. This is the title of a paper, peer-reviewed paper in the Journal of Psychopharmacology. Psilocybin can occasion mystical-type experiences having substantial and sustained personal meaning and spiritual significance. I'd never seen all those words together in a scientific paper. And it opened up this idea that maybe you could study spirituality from a scientific point of view, especially if you could induce the kind of primal religious experience, which of course is the mystical experience. So that was one data point. And then I heard about another study in 2010, and this is really when I decided I wanted to write about this, that they were using psilocybin, the same lab at Johns Hopkins and NYU, giving it to people who had cancer diagnoses. People who, many of whom were terminal, people who were paralyzed by their fear, depression, and anxiety. And they were finding relief after a single guided psychedelic session. This seemed pretty implausible to me. I can't imagine if I were faced with such a diagnosis that I would ever want to put myself in a position where I would lose complete control of my mind, would no doubt go to a very dark place. It just seemed like counterintuitive. So I got an assignment to write about this for The New Yorker, and I started talking to people. And their experiences were so amazing and moving. I'll just tell you about one short case. There's a much longer case I do in the book of a man named Patrick Metis, who I follow through his whole experience and how it changed his last 17 months and allowed him to die with complete equanimity, a remarkable story. But there was this woman I interviewed. She was 60-ish. She had never used a psychedelic. She was a kind of a timorous, timid woman who was a figure skating instructor in Manhattan. And she had had ovarian cancer, and she'd been treated with success, but she was so afraid of a recurrence that, you know, any day this would fall, and that she was paralyzed by this fear of recurrence. So she heard about this trial and went into it and had a very profound experience. And like many of the cancer patients, she imaginatively went into her body. It kind of creates this intra-psychic movie. These are pretty high-dose experiences. And she went into her body. Oh, actually, before I tell you that, I should tell you what I mean by a guided psychedelic experience. Because the image you may have in your head of taking a psychedelic and walking in the woods or, you know, going to a concert is really not what this is about. This is a very controlled experience with two guides, a man and a woman, who are with you the entire time. They prepare you with multiple sessions before you start to what you should expect and what to do if it gets really dark and frightening. Most of their advice, they call it the flight instructions, involve encouraging you to surrender to whatever happens, no matter how unpleasant it is, and that going with the experience is the key to not having a bad trip. So if you see a doorway, open it. If you see a staircase, climb it. If you see a monster, don't turn and run. Go right up to it and say, "What are you doing in my head? What do you have to teach me?" And follow John Lennon's immortal advice: relax your mind and float downstream. So that's the kind of advice you get, and that actually proves to be very, very helpful, especially for cancer patients who will confront their mortality, their death, or their cancer in this experience. And then so they're with you then the whole time. You're lying down. You're on a comfortable couch. You're wearing eye shades, okay? So that's another fundamental difference with the recreational psychedelic experience. And this encourages you to go inside. If you've ever had any experience with psychedelics, you know the difference between having your eyes open and closed is like night and day. So they want you to go inside. And you're listening to music on headphones, usually. That is a very carefully curated playlist that kind of supports the arc of the experience and is actually profoundly important because of synesthesia. You tend to see what the music is doing. It evokes a landscape very often and takes you places. So anyway, that's the guided experience that this woman, her name is Dina Baser. So in her experience, she went into her body, and like a lot of the cancer patients, as I said, but she saw, when she went into her body, a black mass, a big black mass under her rib cage. And she realized it wasn't her cancer, because it wasn't in the right place. It was her fear. And when she saw this black mass, she got really angry. And imagine the guide sitting next to her. They don't know where she is in her head, right? Because they say very little. And suddenly she just screams out, "Get the f*** out of my body!" And they were like, whoa. It's not something you expected from Dina Baser. And later, she, in telling me this story, she explained that what had happened was, and when this happened, the fear just vanished. The black mass was gone. And I wrote this in this article in The New Yorker, and I wrote, just kind of being safe, I mean, we journalists engage in a lot of ass covering, I said, you know, and her fear of death was substantially diminished. And so the fact checkers at The New Yorker called her and said, "Is it true that your fear was substantially diminished?" And she said, "No, he got that all wrong. My fear was eliminated and didn't come back." And when she talked to me about it, what she said was, "I realized that I can't control the cancer. The cancer's going to do what the cancer's going to do, but I can control my fear." And that understanding allowed this her to eliminate, to get rid of this fear and go on with her life, as she continues to do. You know, the idea that a single guided psychedelic trip could have such a profound effect on someone. I mean, compare that to giving someone who is fearful and depressed, you know, an antidepressant. This is the administering of an experience, not a drug. The drug makes the experience possible, but you have to have the experience for it to work. So I got really interested in this. And I'm going to give you one other quick story of a woman I interviewed for this article to give you an idea of the range of experiences. There was a trial at Hopkins to see if these drugs could help people stop smoking. This is a very small, this is just a 15-person pilot study. The cancer trial is a big double-blind, much bigger double-blind. And I couldn't understand why a psilocybin trip would make it easier to stop smoking, which is a very, I mean, if any of you have been smokers or are smokers, it's a very hard addiction to break. So I interviewed this woman, also about 60. She was an Irish book editor. And she told me about her experience, and she said that she had, in her case, she had grown wings, and these wings allowed her to kind of fly all through European history. And she witnessed all these great scenes and battles and things. And then she died three times. And she saw her body rise from a funeral pyre on the Ganges. And she saw the birth of creation. And she said, "And you know, I just realized that the universe was so incredible. And there were so many incredible things to do and see that killing yourself with cigarettes seemed really stupid." Now, I'm sure people had told her that before, but there is a quality of the mystical experience, and I'll define what that is in a second, that William James described back 110 years ago, that he called the noetic quality, that when you're having a mystical experience, which is essentially, I mean, that's a religious vocabulary. You can also call it ego dissolution. I think that, if you want to put it in more psychodynamic terms, it's basically this experience of losing your sense of self. And when that happens, the walls of ego come down and you merge with something larger. And whether it's other people that you feel this powerful love for, or the universe, or the divine, whatever it is, your narrow, contracted sense of who you are suddenly opens up. And that's a very powerful experience. The loss of ego can be terrifying as it happens, but again, if you relax your mind and float downstream and let it happen, it can be ecstatic also. One of the qualities of this mystical experience is the noetic quality. And that is this sense that whatever you have understood, your insights during this experience, they're not just your opinions. They suddenly have the authority of like revealed truth. It's like tablets come down from the mountain. And even banal insights, like smoking is stupid, suddenly have this force and this authority. And that allows people to act on those. You know, why is that? Why should that noetic quality be? I speculate that if you lose your sense of subjectivity, right? Your sense that you are a subject and you merge with everything else, there is no subject-object duality. So whatever you perceive is objectively true. So I don't really understand the metaphysics of it. Nobody does. But this I saw this over and over again, and I had it myself. So I had a lot of journalistic curiosity to see what this experience would be like. I didn't think I could do justice to it in a book without actually having had psychedelic experiences. And I had not had them when I was supposed to have them in college. It wasn't around in my college, which was weird. This is in the 1970s. But also, I was afraid of them. I was very much a creature of that moral panic about psychedelics that happens in the mid-60s. And just as I was coming of age and might have considered it, I was hearing about, you know, college kids staring at the sun till they go blind, and LSD scrambling your chromosomes, and people ending up in the psych ward. And I just thought, like, you got to be crazy to you know, roll the mental dice like this. And so I didn't want to. And I didn't feel sturdy enough. Or a lot of those stories are urban legends. The staring at the sun was actually made up by a commissioner of the blind in Washington State who wanted to discourage kids from using psychedelics. So he just made it up. The scrambled chromosomes was retracted within months of publication. There are risks, though, and before I did this, and I want to address that, so I was something of a nervous Nelly about going into this experience, or these experiences, because I had 6 or 7 guided and 1 unguided psychedelic trip. I did my due diligence as a journalist to see what I could learn about risk. And what I found surprised me, the physical risks, the risks to your body, were surprisingly, and I'm talking about the classic psychedelics, I'm not talking about MDMA here, I'm talking about psilocybin, LSD, DMT, the so-called classic psychedelics, that they're non-toxic or relatively non-toxic, that there is no lethal dose for these drugs, which is remarkable because there are many drugs in your medicine cabinet right now that do have a lethal dose that are more toxic than LSD or psilocybin. It's kind of hard to believe, but that is what the science shows. They're also non-addictive. They're kind of anti-addictive, in fact. Your first thought after a powerful psychedelic journey is not, where can I get more of that stuff? It's like, do I have to ever do this again? I don't think I need to. And indeed, if you know that classic setup where the rat is tied to some contraption and every time he presses the lever in the cage, it administers cocaine to his bloodstream, and then there's another thing that administers food, sugar water, and he'll press the cocaine lever until he dies. You do that same setup with LSD, he'll press it once. Never again. So it's hard to... So people don't get addicted. So it's not a drug of abuse in the sense that we understand drugs of abuse. There are, however, psychological risks. And it's very important. It's a very disruptive psychological experience. And it can be traumatic. It can surface trauma. It can create panic attacks in people who are not prepared. And there are cases of people having psychotic breaks on psychedelics. Would they have had them otherwise? You know, the age at which people, their schizophrenia kicks in is around the same age that people fool around with psychedelics. And I'm sure that there are many people who were tripped off by their trips. That can happen. And in these trials that I'm describing, they very carefully screen out people at any risk for schizophrenia, personality disorder, a serious mental illness. If you have it in your family, they won't take you. Yet, if you compare it to so many other risky things we do, horseback riding, you know, it's less risky than I thought it was. So, for what it's worth, for, you know, how young is it a safe thing for people? You know, it seems to me, given the impact on one's ego, that having a high-dose psychedelic trip before your ego is fully formed seems a little ill-advised. And I know many young people who had great experience with psychedelics, but I also know people who got into trouble, too. So I actually think psychedelics are wasted on the young. That they actually have more value later in life when you're kind of locked into patterns of thought and behavior. And that's kind of like, for me, I passed from having this journalistic curiosity, I have to see what this is about so I can write about it properly, to actually being really jealous of the people I was interviewing. I had never had a spiritual experience, I realized. I felt like I was kind of spiritually retarded, in fact. These people were having these experiences that were changing their perspective and in some dimensions of personality, like openness, at 60. And that's remarkable, because we are really set in concrete by 60. And so the idea that you could shake the snow globe, as one of the neuroscientists I interviewed memorably said, came to seem very appealing. That there were certain experiences of the mind that I had not had, and I had closed myself off to. And the idea that there were these doors in the mind that were there, now I knew they were there, and I had never opened them, seemed like, well, if not now, when? So I set out to have my own experiences. And the book, as you'll soon find out, looks at psychedelics from many different perspectives. There's history in it, there's natural history in it, there's neuroscience, there's therapeutic case studies, and then there's a travelogue of my own experiences. And I want to read you briefly from one of them. My first guided trip was an LSD trip. It wasn't a really super high dose one, for reasons I explained. We were being very cautious. It was like 150 micrograms. And so it wasn't enough to have that experience of ego dissolution. That happened later on psilocybin. But I did, and I expected this kind of these visual fireworks and everything, but in the end, it was not like that at all. It was a very kind of psychological experience. I just was like seeing people in my life. I was, you know, seeing my wife and my son and my parents and my sisters, and just one by one kind of like thinking about my relationship to them and feeling very present to them. And I had this, as many people do, and it's very hard to describe, but I had this very powerful, almost like this cascading dam break of love. Just love for them. And, you know, I love them, but I don't feel it on a daily basis. And I think that's true for a lot of us. We wall ourselves off from strong emotions. And there it was. And so, but I had to write about this. And like, how do you deal with such a banal insight that love is really important? So I want to, I just want to read you a section. And my guide is taking down things I'm telling him. And at one point I said, I don't want to be so stingy with my feelings and all this time spent worrying about my heart. What about all the other hearts in my life? It embarrasses me to write these words. They sound so thin, so banal. This is a failure of my language, no doubt, but perhaps it is not only that. Psychedelic experiences are notoriously hard to render in words. To try is necessarily to do violence to what has been seen and felt, which in some fundamental way is pre- or post-linguistic, or as students of mysticism say, ineffable. Emotions arrive in all their newborn nakedness, unprotected from the harsh light of scrutiny, and especially the pitiless glare of irony. Platitudes that wouldn't seem out of place on a Hallmark card glow with the force of revealed truth. That's that noetic quality. Love is everything. Okay, but what else did you learn? No, you must not have heard me. Love is everything. Is a platitude so deeply felt still just a platitude? No, I decided. A platitude is precisely what is left of a truth after it has been drained of all emotion. To resaturate that dried husk with feeling is to see it again for what it is, the loveliest and most deeply rooted of truths hidden in plain sight. A spiritual insight? Maybe so. Or at least that's how it appeared in the middle of my journey. Psychedelics can make even the most cynical of us into fervent evangelists of the obvious. You could say the medicine makes you stupid, but after my journey through what must sound like a banal and sentimental landscape, I don't think it's that. For what, after all, is the sense of banality or the ironic perspective if not two of the sturdier defenses that the adult ego deploys from keeping to keep from being overwhelmed by our emotions, certainly, but perhaps also by our senses, which are liable at any time to astonish us with news of the sheer wonder of the world. If we are ever to get through the day, we need to put most of what we perceive into boxes labeled known, to be quickly shelved with little thought to the marvels therein, and novel, to which, understandably, we pay more attention, at least until it isn't that anymore. A psychedelic is liable to take all the boxes off the shelf, open and remove even the most familiar items, turning them over and imaginatively scrubbing them until they shine once again with the light of first sight. Is this reclassification of the familiar a waste of time? If it is, then so is a lot of art. It seems to me there is great value in such renovation, the more so as we grow older and come to think we've seen and felt it all before. You know, our minds are tuned to novelty, and they're also, and that's very adaptive. You know, the novel threat, whatever is coming into your, you know, whatever, the new person coming into your field, whatever it is. But it's not tuned to what is very important, which is what's familiar. The people around you, the love you feel for them, all these kind of things. And so the medicines seem to change the balance between those two things. So that was, I found, a very interesting experience. And a question that arises, what's going on in the brain when you're having these experiences, when you're feeling overwhelmed by love, when you're feeling your ego gradually, like the boundaries soften? Because that's what happened on that experience. That's what allowed me to feel that love. Well, this is where the science gets really interesting. When they first began imaging the brains of people on psilocybin and LSD, this was done in England at Imperial College, where there's a very interesting research project. They kind of expected to see this kind of fireworks in the brain, lots of activity in all the different networks. And they were very surprised, though, that when they put people, they gave people an injection of psilocybin, slid them into the fMRI. Can you imagine this? I talked to one of the volunteers who freaked out. I mean, that is really not where you want. I mean, it's hard enough straight, right, to be in an fMRI thing when they're doing your head. But what they found was that this very important brain network that I had never heard of, and in fact the researchers didn't know that much about, was suppressed, downregulated. It goes offline. Something called this default mode network. So what is that? Well, we've only known about it for 15 or 20 years, and it is a tightly linked set of structures that communicate among themselves quite a bit in the midline that connects structures in the cerebral cortex, which is the evolutionarily most recent part of the brain where your executive function is and things like that, to older and deeper structures involved in emotion and memory. The default mode network is involved in self-reflection and self-criticism and rumination. It's kind of where we go when our mind is wandering and we're thinking about ourselves. It's the enough about you network. It's also involved in something called theory of mind, the ability to impute mental states to others, which is very important in moral reasoning and ethical reasoning. And it's involved in time travel, the ability to think about the future and the past. And it's involved in something called the autobiographical self, with the narratives we generate that tell us who we are based on our past and our future objectives. And it's where we incorporate things that happen to us in the story of our lives. And, you know, without that story, we don't have a sense of a continuous self over time.
You're listening to Michael Pollan, Notes from the Psychedelic Underground. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
The sense of self, what we call the ego, and I use those terms sort of interchangeably, if the ego has an address, it's in the default mode network. And this is what goes offline. Now, the ego is involved in kind of patrolling the borders of the self, right? I mean, you and the other, defending you against slights real and imagined. And it's also involved in defending you against internal powerful emotions, memories, your subconscious. And so to remove that from the state of play is a big change in mental function, because the default mode network is also a regulator of the rest of the brain. And when you take it off, when you take it offline, instead of all this mental information passing through the default mode network, and you see that instead of having a couple kind of super highways of connection, every circle is a different brain network on the periphery, suddenly all these new little roads sprout up and the brain is temporarily rewired. And those connections, we don't actually know what those connections are, but they might explain things like hallucinations. So, for example, if your your hippocampus is, or amygdala is talking directly to your visual cortex, you may see your fears. Or if one sense, if your sense of smell is talking to your auditory sense, you may smell musical notes. So all that rewiring happens when you take the default mode network offline, which is kind of amazing. And this is one of the things that psychedelics have taught us. And that's why, I mean, in a way, this book is not really about psychedelics. It's about what psychedelics teaches us about the mind, and when it's working and when it's not working well. The therapeutic value of taking it offline temporarily is that you acquire new perspectives. You connect the dots in new ways. And now, the brain goes back to baseline, yes, but on the other hand, having experienced that perspective, like that woman who gave up smoking, you can reinforce it by remembering it, by talking to your therapist about it. So I had, I want to finish with this. I had a more thorough default mode network disabling experience a little later. I had a high-dose psilocybin experience with a guide. And I should explain, I couldn't participate in the above-ground trials. That's what I would have liked to do. So what I did instead is I discovered along the way of my research that there is a sizable network of underground therapists who are administering these drugs illegally. They're often very professional people trained as therapists, and they just feel that the value is so great of working with these medicines that they're willing to risk their freedom by doing it. I'm sure there are some in your community. So I found my way into this community, and I just have to caution you, though, that, I mean, there are charlatans out there, you know, who hang up a sign saying they're psychedelic guides. So you have to interview people carefully. And I met people I wasn't comfortable with that I just thought were a little too loopy. You know, it's like choosing a therapist. You know your tolerance for unconventional thinking. But I found somebody I really liked and I really trusted, and I was comfortable enough with her to undergo a higher dose experience. And I was trying to simulate the dose that they were using in these trials, which is 4 grams of dried mushrooms or 25 milligrams of synthetic psilocybin. Anyway, I had this trip. The first half of it actually wasn't that good. She was playing this music. And this is a problem, the musical taste of some of the underground guides. And it was someone named Thierry David, who was thrice nominated for Best Chill Groove Album. Note, only nominated. he might live in Boulder, though. I hope I haven't offended him. Anyway, the first thing she put on was, it sounded to me like electronica of some kind. It actually wasn't, but it sounded like electronic music. And the synesthesia generated a computer-generated landscape. And every note became a little stalactite or stalagmite of black foam, like you might see in a recording studio. And I was in this dystopian video game forever, traveling around in it. And it wasn't scary, but it wasn't pleasant. It's not my place. I don't play video games. But I was stuck there, and that can happen. And I had to change the music, and it didn't really work. And finally, I started to panic. I started having this rising feeling, oh my God, I'm trapped. I'm going to be here for the whole day in, like, Thierry David land. So I took off my eye shades, and I wanted to make sure reality was still existing. And I also had to pee. So Mary, the guide, you know, walks me across her loft to the bathroom because I was a little wobbly on my feet. But it was so exciting to see reality again. There was a door, and there's a window, all this great stuff. But it was different because everything was sending me these beams of light. I mean, it was just, everything was jeweled with this morning light. It was spectacular. And then I get into the bathroom. I'm very careful not to look in the mirror I don't know what I'm going to see. Later, I looked in the mirror. And then after producing this spectacular crop of diamonds, I went back and I lay down again, and Mary said, would you like a booster dose? And you know, a very good way to do it is to step up your dose along the way every 40 minutes or so. And I said, yes. I was in for the whole, you know, 4 grams. And so, and I look at her, which I hadn't done before, and Mary, who's blonde and has high cheekbones, and you know, she was in her late 50s at the time, she had been transformed, and she was now a Mexican Indian. She was this Mexican peasant, and she had black hair and like very taut, sun, you know, not burnt, but you know, weathered skin. And and she handed me the mushroom, and her hand was like leathery, and she was wearing this white peasant dress, and I knew who she was. She had turned into Maria Sabina, who's a very important figure in the history of psilocybin. This is the Mazatec Indian in Huatla de Jimenez, who had given Gordon Wasson, the first Westerner to ever try psilocybin in Mexico, in 1955, and I tell the story. I mean, it's an amazing story, because the Spanish, when they got to Mexico, found that the Mexicans had this mushroom that they were using as a sacrament. They called it Tionantecatl, the flesh of the gods. So it's just like the Christian sacrament, right? They were eating the gods. And this really freaked out the Spanish and the church, because, frankly, this was a better sacrament, right? Because you actually did see God. You didn't need any faith, no imagination. There, you could have your direct communication. So this was such a threat to the Spanish that they crushed the mushroom cults. They drove it underground, and it survived underground for 500 years in Mexico. And Gordon Wasson, who is a banker from New York, a J.P. Morgan, an amateur mycologist, gets wind of this and takes 11 trips to Oaxaca, finally finds a woman who's willing to admit and give him the mushrooms. So anyway, Mary had turned into Maria Sabina. And I didn't want to tell her what had happened to her. You know, I thought she might be alarmed. I told her the next day, and she was actually flattered. So anyway, after I have the stepped-up dose, something within a few minutes, something amazing happened, which was that, and this is going to sound weird, I saw myself burst into a cloud of little Post-it notes. Now, who is the I that was seeing the self? I know, that's a problem with our language. You would need a new first-person pronoun to describe what happened to me. There was a separation that happened. And the weird thing was, the I that was perceiving this was completely fine with it, and had no desire to like stack all those pieces of paper back together, which is what you would think would happen, but it was like so disinterested and so unperturbed. And then I looked out again, and I saw myself now, not a bunch of papers, but a thin coat of paint spread out, painted over the landscape. And I was fine with that. And it was the most amazing thing. I had lost my sense of self, yet something remained. There was another ground on which to stand and take in reality, a ground I hadn't known existed. And I can't tell you what that is. I mean, Aldous Huxley would have said it was the mind at large, right? Some sort of transpersonal consciousness. I tend not to think that's what it is, but, you know, we don't really know. But I think it is what those cancer patients were experiencing, the ones who found themselves, you know, looking beyond themselves to what would happen after their death, and that they felt that there was some field of consciousness that would survive them. And the experience went on, and I had a very profound experience with music. We finally found something we agreed on, and it was Bach's Unaccompanied Cello Suites, number 2 in D minor, which is a gorgeous piece of music. It's the saddest piece of music you have ever heard. And I didn't listen to it, I became that music. I went into the cello. I felt, you know, Yo-Yo Ma's bow, the friction of it going, you know, overhead. And it was just this absolute merging with this piece of music. And it was sad, it wasn't ecstatic. But it had the effect of like, this piece is about death. And it just kind of like, for that length of that time, I felt completely reconciled to death. I was just beyond the reach of any suffering or regret. It was just the most amazing thing. And I'm just going to leave you with this. So I had a spiritual experience, but it wasn't what I thought a spiritual experience would be. And in fact, it caused me to redefine what I mean or what I think spiritual means. This may be naive, but I always assumed spiritual was the opposite of material. And so if you were a materialist, if you believe that the laws of nature explain everything, a spiritual experience would be a violation of that. It would be a supernatural experience. But I learned that that's actually not what it is, at least for me. That the opposite of spiritual is egotistical. And that to the extent to which we are walled off by our egos, we're failing to connect. And that's what spiritual—that's what a spiritual experience is, a powerful connection, whether to nature, to other people through love, to the universe, or, if you will, your concept of the divinity. And that it is by laying aside the ego that we achieve that experience. And that was, you know, for me, that was a big insight. And I have this crazy molecule to thank for it. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. Have the question? Okay, so when considering this method, how many sessions can one plan for to experience a shift? So the amazing thing is, it's usually one. In the cancer anxiety study, they had one experience on psilocybin and one on a placebo. In the smoking study, they get two or I think up to three experiences. But it's not a lot. With the depression studies, the people who will have relief, which is not everybody, but it was two-thirds or so, have it after one experience. It fades over time for people with depression, and so they'll probably need to be renewed every 6 months or every year. This is why it will be hard to fit into our medical setting and our pharmaceutical world, because it's not a pill you take every day. So is Big Pharma going to get interested in this? How do they make money on it? And even in psychotherapy, look, therapists count on, you know, weekly sessions that go on forever. So this is a threat to a lot of vested interests. I mean, on the other hand, it's a very intensive day with two therapists consumed for a whole day. So it's a very different model. And how, if it is approved by the FDA, which I think will happen, we'll figure out reimbursements and where will this happen. There's so many questions about designing a structure in which you can conduct, I was about to say psychedelic therapy, but we really should call it psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, because it's not just the molecule. It really is the set and setting, as Timothy Leary said, that makes possible these kind of experiences. If you weren't in an environment where you felt utterly safe, you could not allow your ego to completely turn to pain, right? You would resist that, and you would be very unhappy when you did. Okay. So how can licensed therapists get trained, and how do we obtain psychedelics if they are illegal? Well, I can answer the first part. You have to answer the second part. There's going to be a tremendous need for psychedelic therapists, and there won't be enough because I think the demand is going to exceed the supply. There is right now there's a couple trainings going on, but one is being done in San Francisco at a place called the California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS. I wrote about this actually in the New York Times. I attended one of their sessions, and it's a 7-session non-resident program. So people come from all over the country. They're on their third cohort, and they're training people to participate in these trials. Everybody's licensed, you know, has some sort of degree. There were oncologists there and psychiatrists, but also social workers and counselors, and they're being trained to do this work. MAPS also, which is conducting the MDMA work, some of which is going on in Boulder. Is doing their own trainings, And MDMA is not a classical psychedelic, but it's another illegal drug that is also an adjunct to psychotherapy that's proved to be very effective in the treatment of people with post-traumatic stress, vets and victims of sexual abuse especially. And that'll probably be the first of these medicines to be approved by the FDA. So there are opportunities to train. In terms of obtaining the medicines, you know, it's important to remember they're illegal. And the government hasn't taken a keen interest in psychedelics in recent years, but if there is an explosion of interest in it, they might well. So, you know, everybody needs to be very careful. Okay. So how can I discover resources for this process? If you go to michaelpollan.com and pull down the resources, there's a whole set of psychedelic resources. It also has listings of psychedelic societies, which are in, you know, now 100 different cities in America, where you can find people interested in this kind of work. So this one's totally blank. This is so cosmic. It's an invitation to talk about anything I want. Why do you believe someone with psychological issues such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, should not participate? Well, it's not my belief. It is the belief of the therapist. There were some experiments with schizophrenia in the 50s. They weren't the... I didn't really talk about the history, but you know, most of us have this idea that psychedelics kind of began in the 60s and is a product of the 60s. In fact, the 60s was just one really interesting chapter in a much longer history. And in the 50s, there was a very fertile period of research. And they were trying these drugs on lots of different illnesses to see what it worked with best. And that's where, and the things we're using it for now are things we actually discovered then. Very good for addiction, alcoholism especially, but other addictions. Did you know Bill W., the founder of AA, got sober on a psychedelic experience in the 30s and then tried to introduce LSD to the fellowship in the 50s. And the board said, this kind of muddies our brand. They didn't go along with it. But he, and you know, the higher power, that's such an important part of AA, that I've always assumed it was kind of a sublimated Christianity that was part of it. In fact, that was the higher power of the psychedelic experience. So the DNA of psychedelics is all over AA. But I don't think the work with serious mental illness was that successful. And, you know, one way to think about what the drugs are good for is that if you think of the brain as a spectrum going from a state of disorder to a state of order, and there's a very interesting discussion of this from a neuroscientist in England. His theory is, this is Robin Carhart-Harris, that there are a set of mental illnesses that are very closely related. Addiction, depression, obsession, probably eating disorders, that are all the result of a hyperactive default mode network. An ego that's very punishing. A set of stories in which we trap ourselves in loops and keep repeating. You know, I can't get through the day without a drink. I'm unworthy of love. These stories we tell ourselves, our ego tells us, can get very destructive. And he posits that some brains get too ordered, that you can have an excess of order in your brain. This is a rigidity of thinking. And that the drugs work best because they disorder the brain. They lubricate cognition, as he said. Illnesses like schizophrenia are all the way on the other end. They're the products of a disordered brain that needs more order, not less. So it's kind of redundant with schizophrenics. That's at least his thinking. And it does suggest, and this is one of the interesting things psychedelics is teaching us, is that all these mental illnesses we think of as separate and different may be very closely related, different expressions of the same frozen mental state, and that's why they all respond to the same intervention. And of course, they also, you know, that range also responds sometimes to SSRIs. anxiety, depression. And anxiety and depression may not be that different. As one person I quote said, depression is regret about the past, and anxiety is regret about the future. It's like, oh, yeah. But in both cases, time travel, right? Too much time travel. Have you seen any studies with psilocybin and other non-psychedelic studies, in particular psilocybin and lion's mane for neuroregeneration? Lion's mane is another mushroom. I know that people are working on that, and that Paul Stamets, who's a kind of famous mycologist, has been working on some preparations combining psilocybin with other mushrooms that he thinks might be helpful, but he hasn't gotten too far with it. In terms of neuroregeneration, you know, there's some very sketchy evidence that that these drugs may increase neuroplasticity, and there have been some studies in animals that there is some neuroregeneration that goes on, but it's not research ready for prime time yet, I don't think. How would your wife say you have changed through this process? So I think that's a good place to end. No, I'll tell you. So when I started on this, my wife was of two minds. Her name is Judith, and we've been together since college. We've been together a really long time. And she was excited that I was embarking on a new subject. She was probably sick of hearing me talk about food. So she was all for that. She's a painter, and she's a very restless artist. Her work is changing like every year in radical ways. And my work has changed more slowly. So she was excited about that, but she confessed to being really, to having a lot of trepidation about the fact that I was going to have a big experience, a big life experience. In that study of the one I read you the title of, those people said that their mystical experiences were the top three experiences in their entire lives, comparable to the birth of a child or the death of a parent. So I was going to have a big experience that she wasn't going to be part of. And so that was a concern. And the other was that I would change in some way. What she didn't think of is that I might change for the better. And actually, she thinks I have. I've been asked this question a lot, so, you know, who knows you better than your spouse, right? Your partner. And so I asked her, I said, you know, how would you answer that question? Because I felt in subtle ways I was different, but not night and day, not profound ways. I mean, I'm back to baseline in lots of ways. But she said that, you know, my dad died in January, and I was very involved with the whole process. I moved to the East Coast, and I was, you know, living with him and my mother in their apartment for the last 10 days. And dying at home is not easy. It's what he wanted, and it's the best of some pretty lousy alternatives. And she said something interesting. She said that, I don't know that you would have been so present for that experience if you hadn't had this experience. And indeed, I had been talking to all these people, many of whom were dying, hearing their stories. And in some sense, that left me more open. One of the big things our egos defend us against is death. Thinking about it, exposing ourselves to it, because the ego wants us to be immortal. And you have to be willing to put aside your ego to some extent to really deal with death. Everything got said. I was very available to my father emotionally. He never really wanted to talk about. To this day, I don't know how he was processing his. He had a terminal diagnosis for a couple of years. And one of the reasons I got so interested in this work was because I couldn't have that conversation with him. I realized after the fact, and I could have it with these volunteers in these studies. In that sense, you know, I think I'm a little less. After my ego-dissolving experience on psilocybin, when I went back to Mary, you know, I said to her, my big takeaway was that there's another ground on which to stand, and you don't have to identify with your ego. And she said, well, isn't that worth the price of admission? And I said, yes, but now my ego is back in uniform and on patrol, so what good is that? And she said something interesting, and I'll leave you with this. She said that, you know, well, you've had a taste of that other perspective, and you can cultivate it. And I asked her, how? How would I cultivate it? And she said, through meditation. And I did find that it was through meditation that I could reconnect to that disinterested form of consciousness. It made me a better meditator too, because I had a sense of the destination. I know you're not supposed to strive in meditation. Sorry. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for your attention. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
You were just listening to Michael Pollan, Notes from the Psychedelic Underground. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado. Michael Pollan is the best-selling author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and How to Change Your Mind. Time magazine named him on its list of the 100 most influential people in the world. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices from Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz to Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Michael Pollan, Notes from the Psychedelic Underground, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to the Boulder Bookstore. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.